You're listening to a podcast hosted by Med Learning Group.
Hello and welcome to this podcast. How do you optimally select third-line treatment options for metastatic colorectal cancer? First and second-line treatment options in patients with metastatic colorectal cancer combine chemotherapy with targeted therapies that rely on the molecular profile of the tumor. However, once the disease has progressed, third-line treatment selection is challenging, guided by tumor burden, prior therapies, toxicities, performance status, and patient preferences. Hi, I'm Dr. Shubham Pant, and I'm pleased to be joined by my colleague, Dr. Benjamin Musher from Baylor College of Medicine in Houston, to discuss strategies for selecting optimal sequencing of available therapies for metastatic colorectal cancer in the third line setting. Welcome, Dr. Musher.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. So Ben, you know, there's so much new things which are happening in the field of colorectal cancer, especially in the third line setting. So could you just set the stage and tell us what are the therapies right now which are available for physicians to treat these patients in the third line setting?
Well, I assume you mean people who have already received 5-FU, irinotecan, oxaliplatin, EGFR inhibitor if there's no RAS mutation, et cetera, and that might be second line or third line or fourth line. But what it comes down to it is that there are three, assuming that there is not a specific target, KRAS G12C mutation, HER2, we can get that if you want to, but assuming there's not one of those, you're really talking about three options. One is TAS-102, or the brand name Lonsurf, combined with bevacizumab, or used by itself, fruquintinib, or regorafenib. Those are the three options that you have. Each has its upsides and its downsides, and unfortunately, they've not been compared head-to-head.
They have not been. You're exactly right. They've not been compared to head-to-head, which is a challenge. But tell us a little bit about, let's say a patient comes to you, and we are doing this show for veterans and for physicians who treat veterans, you know, normally have comorbidities, you know, some, you know, other issues. So tell me a little bit about, like, how do you choose? You know, you have these three kind of options, right? You have regorafenib, you have TAS-102, you know, with or without bevacizumab, or fruquintinib. You know, how do you choose one patient versus the other that, you know, if you're not selecting a target, like, how do you choose that?
As you alluded to before, just like any time we make treatment decisions, there are going to be several categories of factors that come into play. There's efficacy, toxicity, which will, to a certain extent, rely on comorbidities, convenience, performance status, prior therapies they've gotten. And then obviously you have to look at the data for these medications. So I think what's really important to know is there's some commonalities. These drugs were only tested in people that had a good performance status. These drugs do not carry a high response rate, for example. So if you have someone with big burn disease and they're already in liver failure and you need to shrink cancer, none of these options is going to be very good for you. Past that, it's just a matter of details. So for example, we know that two of these agents have a main target is going to be VEGF. So especially in the veteran population, there's a lot of hypertension, a lot of coronary disease. And if you've got uncontrolled hypertension or coronary disease, then fruquintinib may not be a good option for you. Using regorafenib may not be a good option for you. Maybe not quite as bad as fruquintinib. On the other hand, TAS-102 by itself might be fine, but using with bevacizumab might be problematic. So that is one thing we have to take into account. There's a matter of convenience. Some people don't want to have to come every 2 weeks for an infusion. So bevacizumab is off the table. Again, I don't have any hard evidence to show this, but if I have a choice between using TAS-102 by itself or using fruquintinib or regorafenib by itself, I'm probably going to use fruquintinib or regorafenib by itself. The data for TAS-102 and bevacizumab are a little bit stronger. So that is also that comes into play. So you're really going to have to look at all these things, and there's not going to be anything ideal. One other thing I should mention is that of these three drugs, fruquintinib is the one that the FRESCO trial did allow patients who had gotten one or both of those other agents, TAS-102 or regorafenib, to have received previously. So if you're really trying to sequence these and someone's eligible for all three, you might want to save the fruquintinib for a little bit later because there are data for people who've gotten those other two drugs previously. So, you know, I don't think there's not going to be a perfect algorithm, but those are the same things we have to think about.
Yeah, if they had just compared some of these agents next to each other, it would have been easier. And you're right, fruquintinib, you can actually treat later in later lines. after they've had either regorafenib or TAS-102 or TAS-102 and BEV. So it's kind of something that can be used in later line. That's definitely a consideration. Let's say the prior therapies, and I'm sure that goes into the answer that you just gave me, you know, play into your fact for the next therapy, right? So if they had some toxicity, let's say neutropenia or, you know, uncontrolled high blood pressure, like how much do you look at, let's say a patient comes to you as a referral from the community, you know, you're looking at the patient, you're going, okay, they're my third line patient. When you go back and look at, you know, what they've received front and second line, how much does that play into your decision for giving this third line therapy?
So those three drugs, TAS-102 is probably the one that's going to cause, there's the highest chance of causing neutropenia, for example. So if that's been a problem in the past, you run a low white cell at baseline, which a lot of people do, that may not be as good of an option for you. If you've had problems with hypertension when you've been on bevacizumab previously, fruquintinib or regorafenib might be a problem for you as well. Clearly, if there are some compliance problems, that might come into play as well. So yes, I mean, clearly, if you've had these before, one other thing I think deserves mention is a lot of people come in with some neuropathy, and throwing some hand-foot syndrome into the equation could also be problematic. And a couple of these agents have a higher chance of causing hand-foot syndrome. The other thing is just sort of the gut feeling, which is how people tolerate these medications in general. I think it deserves mentioning that nobody, in my opinion, nobody should really start a patient on full dose regorafenib.
Actually, I'm old enough in a way to remember when regorafenib just came out. And I remember my first patient, she was this she was a woman who was very active, and she would like, you know, clean her whole house and was like, you know, make these four courses meals and everything. And, you know, she was progressing on, you know, FOLFIRI frontline with Bev. And I gave her, I was like, oh, I've got this new drug, you know, not high response rate, but some progression-free survival benefit. And I gave them, you know, the full dose regorafenib. And man, she came to me a couple of weeks back and she couldn't do anything. High rates of fatigue and everything. So it's definitely, there's something to be said about dosing. So maybe you could tell us a little bit more, Ben, I think, because this is very important kind of for the veteran population also, because there might be, again, issues coming in with comorbidities, fatigue, and then you're giving them full dose. So tell me a little bit about what full dose regorafenib is and a little bit about, I think, what you were mentioning too, the redose trial, about, you know, how we can really, you know, help our veterans and help patients get through regorafenib.
Full dose regorafenib is 160 milligrams, 3 weeks on, 1 week off. And those of us who have used this medication don't really even understand how this trial finished accrual, based on the fact that it's really hard to get anybody to tolerate 160 and even 120. It's extremely hard to get people up to 120. So there was a follow-up study called the redose study after it became clear that in the real world setting, 160 was tough, in which they started at 80 and they titrated by an additional tablet or 40 milligrams weekly. And I like this approach. We were already using that approach before redose was published. And what you'll find is if you can get more people to stay on the medication for a longer period of time. As we know, a lot of people have benefit from lower doses of therapies anyway, but if you can't tolerate it at all, then you're not going to get benefit from it. So the approach is starting at 80 and then either giving the patient a call, video visit, bringing them back in, whatever, after a week, going up to 120 is a very reasonable thing to do. I'll even sometimes wait a little bit longer, even 2 weeks sometimes. There's not a perfect answer to this one, but you want to try to get someone to the maximum dose they can tolerate. When I say they can tolerate, we really have to keep quality of life in mind here. I don't mean that you're keeping them out of the hospital. I mean, toward your point, is you can keep somebody who's been active, right? You want them to enjoy what time they have left. And that's obviously a difficult thing to do. So if someone is teetering on the edge of bad performance status, regorafenib may not be a great one for them. I would say of the three options, going back to your original question, TAS-102 probably causes the least fatigue of the three. It can cause some GI side effects, but again, myelosuppression is an issue. So that's something that would need to be balanced. If I may, I had this decision to make a couple weeks ago. I'd had a patient who had a stoma that was bleeding, and it would ooze, and it would ooze, and it would stop, and it would ooze. And when she was on bevacizumab, it clearly made it worse, to the point where I had to stop bevacizumab. So then I got to the point where she had already progressed on the available options, aside from these three drugs. And it was a no-brainer to me. Fruquintinib was out of the question. Regorafenib was highly suspect as well. And so I started her on TAS 102, obviously without the bevacizumab. So sometimes the answer will become clear. Otherwise, it's going to be more of a judgment call.
So you're saying exactly, you have to look at what they were treated previously. If there's neutropenia or myelosuppression, then maybe you try the other therapies. But if they've, again, have this bleeding issues or something, but then you try. So, and I think this was a great story with regorafenib, that kind of the data caught up to what the physicians were already doing, right? Anyway, I mean, now we've had it for like more than a decade, but do you ever start them at even lower dose? Like is the 80, do you ever start them 40, or this 80 is starting and you think most patients can tolerate the 80 milligrams when you start with regorafenib?
Yeah, I think most people can tolerate 80. I've never started people at 40. I've had to go down to 40 like maybe once or twice, but I don't know. I mean, if the trial was done at 160 and you're trying to treat someone at 40, that's starting to make me concerned that maybe there's no efficacy there. I don't think there's anything wrong with doing that. But if you start at 40, I would try to titrate them up relatively quickly after that, because you also don't want to lose any potential efficacy. But what's important about that study is they were actually able to show that with the dose escalation approach, the overall survival appeared to be better, probably because you keep people on the drug for a longer period of time, at least compared to the non-dose escalation and compared to the cross-trial comparison to the original trial that was published. So it's just a great example of how if you can keep the toxicity down and keep the drug in place, so to speak, you can get more benefit from it.
No, I think that's a fantastic drug development story. What about, you know, with a Sunlight trial with the addition of bevacizumab, you know, shows an improvement? What do you think about that data? You know, there were patients who were treated prior with bevacizumab, but there were patients who did not receive prior bevacizumab. So where do you think, let's say a patient at least in the US, right? A lot of the sites were in Europe, but at least in the US, you know, patients are, if they're eligible, they've received bevacizumab before. So a patient who received Bev before, and they progress through it, do you continue the bevacizumab? Let's say they didn't have any side effects. They control, you know, Bev, they didn't have any Bev-related side effects. Do you continue the bevacizumab, or would you use just, you know, the TAS 102 by itself?
As you said, as long as the people tolerate the Bev okay, there are no contraindications, and they're willing to come in every couple weeks for their Bev infusion, I typically continue it. Thankfully, as you said, we do have data for bevacizumab beyond progression from FOLFOX to FOLFIRI or FOLFIRI to FOLFOX. So there might be something to it here that if you use it beyond progression, it might have benefit there too. But as long as there's no obvious downside to it, I do offer it to patients.
Great. And then quickly now we'll go to, we'll go with the targeted therapy. So if you have a KRAS G12C, do you think about using adagrasib and cetuximab? And any thoughts for our listeners on, like, you know, any caveats or any thoughts that you have on that data?
Yeah, absolutely. I have used it a few times now. You and I have spoken about this in the past. I would say, let me see, two out of the three times I've used it in colorectal cancer, I've seen really nice serologic response. And one of those was a very nice objective, a radiographic response. That's actually a great opportunity. As you know, it's a rare KRAS mutation in colorectal cancer, which is why the newer RAS inhibitors are very important, the G12Ds and the G12Vs, et cetera. But yes, that is obviously something that we look out for, which is why when I'm working with my fellows and they say there's a KRAS mutated cancer, I say, well, which KRAS mutation is it? Because it used to just be KRAS and then it was RAS, and now we're back to KRAS G12C or whatever it is specifically. So it's important when you run your NGS to put in your note what KRAS mutation it is, you don't lose the opportunity to use this drug down the road. And yes, I have used it with cetuximab just to get the double blockade of that pathway.
Great. And then to end, just tell us a little bit about HER2. If you have any HER2 patients, what do you think about the tucatinib plus trastuzumab data out of the Mountaineer trial?
Yeah, you know, that's a little bit tougher because, as everybody knows, that in that particular trial was patients who'd been treated before but they hadn't gotten HER2 therapy correct. That's correct, right? Shibum, they hadn't gotten HER2 therapy before. So these are going to be, by definition, people who are HER2 naive, anti-HER2 therapy naive, but have already gotten chemotherapy in the past. So for example, if you've already gotten FOLFOX with trastuzumab or something like that, then you wouldn't have fit into the criteria for that study. And obviously the competitor here might be using an ADC, right?
On HER2. Just again, yep.
Yeah, so that has very good responses. But the response rate with the tucatinib data, very good response rate. I believe it was somewhere 35-40%, which is about the same as the ADC. So I think those are both good options. But again, it depends on what they've gotten previously.
No, you're exactly right. And then with the tucatinib and trastuzumab, you've got to look at the diarrhea also. But Ben, you know, I really want to thank you so much. Great insight. That's all the time we have for today. Like I said, I want to thank Dr. Musher for sharing his insights and experience with us regarding on how to choose third-line treatment options for patients with metastatic colorectal cancer. And I want to thank the listeners for joining us. We hope you will listen to the second episode of this series. This podcast was brought to you by Med Learning Group. Med Learning Group is accredited by the Accreditation Council for Continuing Medical Education to provide continuing medical education for physicians. This CME activity was planned and produced in accordance with the ACCME Essentials. And a special thank you to our supporter, Bayer Healthcare Pharmaceuticals Incorporated, who provided an educational grant for this activity. Thank you so much.